Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. Since the first language users started telling stories about the mountains, lightning, and stars, humans have sought for signs of the divine in nature. For simpler societies, the simple majesty of a sunset or an ocean was enough to inspire reverent awe, and the obeisance to priest castes that came with it. As naturalistic explanation progressed, the alleged evidence of divine handiwork shifted from the natural wonders to the existence of life and the universe itself. Where, the theists challenged the naturalists, did the universe come from? Life could not have come from nothing. But science now has quite plausible, albeit unverifiable, explanations for the processes that make universes and life, explanations that do not require deus ex machina, a god from the wings. In reaction against the growing edifice of scientific explanation, religious fundamentalists have waged guerrilla war by desperately picking at the lacunae of evolutionary and cosmological theories and trumpeting alleged evidence supporting canonical stories of creation. Today, a new theory has entered the field to do battle against secularist explanation and defend the possibility of divine creation by the name of intelligent design theory. ID theorists assert that the same statistical techniques that test for the existence of human intelligence in code breaking, ID theorists assert that the same statistical techniques that test for the existence of human intelligence in code breaking, or the search for extraterrestrial intelligence in the noise generated by radio telescopes, can be turned to the search for a divine hand in the creation of things and the universe itself. One leading ID theorist is William Dembski, professor in the Conceptual Foundations of Science at Baylor University, author of No Free Lunch, Why Specified Complexity Cannot Be Purchased Without Intelligence, who will be our first guest today. Later in the show, we will also speak with Nick Bostrom, visiting scholar in the philosophy department at Yale University, author of Anthropic Bias, Observation Selection Effects in Science and Philosophy, and chair of the World Transhumanist Association. Dr. Bostrom will discuss the relevance of statistical anomalies in arguments for divine creation. First, let's meet Dr. Dembski. Why don't you tell us what your definition of intelligent design theory is, and then how you see it as different from the creation science domain that has...
Right. Intelligent design looks at features of the world and tries to infer from them or detect the effects of intelligence there. And I stress the effects of intelligence. It's not that we're trying to get into the mind of the designer. We look at things and we can sometimes tell, oh, this thing is designed, this thing is the result of natural causes. So if you're driving through southwest South Dakota and you see a rock formation that looks like Teddy Roosevelt, Abe Lincoln, Tom Jefferson, and George Washington, you don't say, gee, isn't it amazing what weather and erosion can do? You know, you say, well, there's design there. Now, you know, cases like that are very easy to deal with and straightforward. Where things get dicey is in the natural sciences, where usually it's presupposed that all you had operating were natural, undirected causes, and then intelligence emerged through a blind evolutionary process. So what I've done is I've developed some techniques for identifying the effects of intelligent causes. Then the question is, what happens when you take those techniques, which are used in a lot of special sciences already, forensic science, search for extraterrestrial, and others, take those techniques and you focus them on, let's say, a biological system. And what if it tells you that the system is designed? Well, is there a science to be done? Are there interesting questions that arise from that? Does that counter the Darwinian theory? All of these questions, then.
And how would you characterize the difference between that set of questions from creation science in general?
Yeah, well, creation science, I mean, it commits you to Genesis literalism, so intelligent design has no stake in the Bible as a scientific text. But beyond that, creation is always a theological doctrine. Creation talks about what is the source of being of the world. How did the world come into existence? Intelligent design looks at configurations of pre-existing stuff. You've got letters of the alphabet, Scrabble piece. Where did they come from? Well, that's really not what intelligent design is interested in. Intelligent design is interested in looking at the arrangement of those letters. Are there arrangements of those letters which would convey meaning or which would indicate that you're dealing with intelligence? If those letters spell out a Shakespearean sonnet, you're going to know that there is intelligence behind that. If they're just a random jumble, there isn't. But intelligent design isn't trying to account for the source of things, where things came from in some ultimate sense. The doctrine of creation is always a theological doctrine and asks, where did things come from? Intelligent design is content just to look at the arrangement of existing things. In a lot of different areas already, a lot of special sciences, archaeology, search for extraterrestrial intelligence, you know, cryptography, all of these special sciences could not even get off the ground if you didn't have a notion of intelligent agency. I mean, you saw the movie Contact, came out about 4 or 5 years ago, based on a novel by Carl Sagan. This is a search for extraterrestrial intelligences. And the thing is, what are the actual SETI researchers doing? They're looking at radio signals coming in from outer space. They don't have the actual intelligences or embodied forms here. They're just looking at signals. And what is it about a signal that would reliably point us to an intelligence? You know, and I've debated Stu Kaufman at the Santa Fe Institute on these subjects, and he agrees that these techniques are valid and that you couldn't, without having design detection techniques, you could not even get the SETI program off the ground. It's just that he doesn't think that they apply to biology. Okay, but that's something we can debate. But the legitimacy of design detection, its role in the natural sciences, I think it, at the very least, it needs to be a part of the scientist's tool chest. I mean, even to keep science honest, we have techniques, design detection techniques for identifying data fraud. So, yeah. It becomes a very artificial, it seems to me, imposition to say, you know, we're just going to limit ourselves to these undirected natural causes, chance and necessity, and we will not allow design in the door. I mean, who makes the rules of science? I mean, it's not that this is just dropped from the sky.
The SETI researchers have been debating a set of equations for the likelihood that life would have developed on Earth for some time, and I assume that that's a central interest of yours as well. And the great difficulty with those equations is the huge set of unknowns. The constraints on any one of the parts of the equation are enormous, and so you can end up with a calculation that life should be teeming throughout the universe or a calculation that we would be the only thing in the whole universe. Doesn't that constrain our ability to even argue these points?
Well, I think with the SETI, it actually is quite difficult to make the estimate. But but I think for the sort of systems that I'm looking at in biology, some of these actually are quite tractable, especially when you're looking at individual enzymes or some of these molecular machines that a colleague of mine named Michael Behe looks at. So, you know, it depends. You have to take these things case by case. You know, some probabilities you can't even get off the ground trying to estimate. But it seems to me that you have to look at the problems. And
give me an example.
The problem is difficult doesn't mean that, you know, we throw up our hands. That's what scientists do, try to solve difficult problems.
Give me an example of one of the more clear cases where you see at a micrological level there some example of statistical anomaly.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't, you know, to call it a statistical anomaly, I mean, I'm not even sure I'd want to say that. I've got a colleague at the University of Cambridge. He's not gone public on this, so I'm not going to give his name, but I've been following his research. I mean, some of it's been published in PNAS, Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, Journal of Molecular Evolution. And what he's looking at is an individual enzyme and looking at how sparsely a given functional enzyme type is distributed in an island of non-functional stuff. Now, if the non-functional stuff is sufficiently large, and if the improbability of landing in this functional island is sufficiently small, then he's getting some very precise estimates. It means there's good evidence, then, that you're not going to be able to evolve into or out of these things by some sort of gradual Darwinian process. Now, that's a strong negative result, but that's along the lines of, I mean, what he's doing parallels my work. I mean, and in fact, it ends up being an application of the sorts of techniques developed.
Anomalies, these kinds of anomalies at the micro level are part of your argument. Are you also concerned about these cosmological anomalies, such as, for instance, the unlikelihood of the various constants of our universe, of our solar system?
I know one of my colleagues, Bill Craig, has been taking these design detection techniques, applying them at the level of cosmology. I've never been that persuaded by them. It seems to me that you have to make some, you're always making some metaphysical assumptions. One way I distinguish what's going on at the level of cosmology with what's going on in biology is to think of, with the design question that is to think of the distinction between an oil painting, the actual oil that's painted on a painting, and the canvas. When you're looking at cosmology, you're looking at the structure of the universe, the laws, the backdrop within which natural history occurs. Now, you could ask, is that canvas itself designed? And that would correspond to the design of the universe. Then you can ask, well, what's painted on the canvas designed? Because it could just be random oil paints. You know, and that would correspond to design in the universe. So what I would distinguish is between design of the universe and design in the universe. When you're dealing with design in the universe, the naturalistic Darwinian evolutionist and the intelligent design theorist can agree on the physics and chemistry of building blocks for life. We're going to be agreed on that. But when you get to the fundamental laws of physics, the origin of the universe, probabilities assigned to those laws, boundary conditions. To me, you're always making metaphysical assumptions. It's really hard to ground that empirically in scientifically rigorous way. So that's why I...
Sciences of complexity, you say that you've had discussions with Kaufman and others there who are experts on that. You don't think that that region of investigation offers a potential bootstrapping of complexity, discontinuous jumps in its levels of organization.
Once this community puts forward some concrete laws, investigate, see what their empirical consequences are, then I think there'll be something there. But at this point, I think there's a lot of hand waving, a lot of computer simulations which gesture at what they're hoping to get, but nothing really concrete.
Even if it was unlikely that there were sufficient time, the right kind of soup, the right kind of catalytic reactions on our planet for life to evolve, there are a set of other theories such as panspermia. Now, panspermia just kind of sets the problem back a piece. Where does the pan sperm come from? But as I understand it, you're not wedded to any particular theological explanation, but rather the evidence of intelligence. So the intelligence that could have caused the various kinds of design that you're looking for could be extraterrestrial and totally material intelligence, and not a supernatural cause.
It's certainly a possibility. I think what makes that approach much more difficult than it was in time past is that the universe, at least the known physical universe, is a very finite and small place. I mean, I know it seems large to us when we get out our telescopes, but it's only been around so long, and there are only so many elementary particles. There's just not that much stuff actually there when you start cranking numbers. So when you're trying to say that, let's say you've got life that formed elsewhere, you've got intelligent life that formed elsewhere and then seeded planet Earth. I mean, that's Francis Crick's directed panspermia theory. Then you have to ask, well, where did those beings come from? Because what you're dealing with are embodied intelligence, intelligences that are localized in space and time, much as we are. And and those could not have always been here. I mean, when you go back to the Big Bang, the conditions of the early universe were too hot and tempestuous to allow for embodied intelligences of any sort that we have any equate with.
Well, I'm sorry we actually have to bring it to a close because it's a fascinating discussion. But I want to recommend to folks that they take a look at No Free Lunch, Why Specified Complexity Cannot Be Purchased Without Intelligence. And you also have forthcoming collection Darwinism and Design in the year 2003.
2003, Cambridge University Press, Debating Design from Darwin to DNA, uh-huh, with Michael Ruse.
Great. Thank you so much for joining us. I've been speaking with William Dembski. He's a professor in the Conceptual Foundations of Science at Baylor University. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Thank you for the opportunity.
What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening. 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 What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening.
want to know, don't you? I'm speaking now with Nick Bostrom. He's a visiting scholar in philosophy at Yale University and the author recently now of Anthropic Bias, Observation Selection Effects in Science and Philosophy. Welcome, Nick.
Thank you.
Now, I've just spoken with William Dembski, who's one of the founders of intelligent design theory, and we've spoken about the apparent complexity of our universe. Tell us a little bit about what is the anthropic bias hypothesis, and how does it relate to the observation of statistical unlikelihoods in our environment?
Well, anthropic biases are kind of biases that are introduced not by limitations in our measurement instruments, that you have to take such biases into account has long been recognized. But anthropic biases are due to the fact that our evidence is biased not just by limitations in our instruments, but also by the fact that there has to be a suitably positioned observer to have the evidence or to build the instruments in the first place. Now, this is related to the creation science debate in that it's relevant when you try to estimate the probability of something like intelligent life arising on an Earth-like planet. If you want to estimate that, now we have one data point. We have our observations of our own planet. But the way that that one data point is relevant to the hypothesis about the processes that created life, that involves an observation selection effect. And you need some kind of theory of how to take that into account.
What are the different approaches that philosophers use? Is there a commonly accepted argument that one can make on the basis of an observation bias?
The recognition that there are observation selection effects and that they are often important in these fields, it has been along since, at least since Brandon Carter's work in the 1970s. But there hasn't been a systematic theory of how to do it. In the case of the evidence that we have evolved here, some sort of a naive reasoner might think that, okay, we have one data point. On this planet, intelligent life evolved, so it seems that it's quite likely for an Earth-like planet to give rise to intelligent life. Now, if you reflect on this for a second, you realize that no, not really. The evidence doesn't warrant that, because even if for any given Earth-like planet it was extremely improbable that it would give rise to intelligent life, even given that hypothesis, where should we expect to find ourselves? What should we expect to observe? Well, obviously not that we're living on a lifeless planet where life fails to evolve. On the contrary, even that theory, which says that the evolution of intelligent life was very improbable, that theory also predicts that we should observe exactly what we are observing, namely that we find ourselves on one of those planets where intelligent life did, in fact, evolve. So it's relevant if you're trying to counter an objection against evolution theory. The objection goes something like this, that there is as yet no, we have never observed the evolution of a more complex organism from a less complex organism directly in the laboratory. And also, the theoretical accounts of how the evolution of more and more complex organisms could come about, it's rather sketchy. So creation scientists have their own account of how this happened. An intelligent design decided that there should be intelligence and that created it. They then challenge mainstream evolutionary biologists in that the mainstream evolutionary biologists haven't really accounted for this some process that could sufficiently raise the chance for evolution from simpler organisms to more complex organisms. And mainstream evolutionary biologists have said, well, okay, our science is not mature yet. We hope to fill in these gaps in our explanation. So it's been a promissory note, but that's kind of the state of the art. But what taking into account observation selection effects does is that it changes the burden of proof, because no longer would an evolutionary biologist have to come up with an explanation that shows that it was probable for complex, intelligent life to arise from simple life forms or from inorganic matter on an Earth-like planet. There doesn't have to be any such likely-making processes, because you could invoke an observation selection effect. You could coherently claim that for any given planet, it's extremely unlikely that intelligent life will arise. It requires hugely improbable coincidences, ridiculously rare multi-loci mutations that just have to happen in the right way, by chance, for this to happen. But even if that's true, then the theory still predicts our observations perfectly, namely that we find ourselves on one of the planets where all those ridiculously improbable events just happened.
Isn't that a matter of degree, though? I mean, what if your statistical calculation determined that the likelihood of life on Earth life like the life on Earth was virtually impossible throughout the entire universe. Wouldn't that argue for an intelligent design?
Yes, it would. There is a limit to how far you can push this observation selection effect to account for observation. If the improbability that the theory postulates for how improbable it is for intelligent life to rise on any given planet, if that improbability was so great that there are not enough planets in the universe to, when you multiply that number of planets with the improbability to get a reasonable probability of intelligent life evolving somewhere, then our evidence would indeed count against such hypotheses. So there is a limitation. It can't explain just anything. It's not an hypothesis that would work no matter what we find out about the world. But as a matter of fact, our best current cosmological theories suggest that the universe contains infinitely many planets. And in that case, there is certainly a sufficient population of planets to draw from on which this observation selection effect could operate to explain appearances.
Let's take a step back. You're saying there are cosmological theories that our universe, or just our universe, it contains an infinite number of planets?
Yes, that's correct. In the standard Big Bang model of the universe, there are basically three possibilities. We can have an open, closed, or flat universe. Current empirical evidence suggests that we are living in an open universe, although that's not completely settled yet. That's the weight of the evidence suggests. And on the simplest topology, assuming what cosmologists call a singly connected space-time, but that's the most straightforward version of the open universe hypothesis, the universe is currently spatially infinite and contains infinite stars, planets, and galaxies. It's also true that there are various other theories according to which our universe is just one in a big ensemble of universes, so-called multiverse theories. And they, of course, would only add extra stuff into the realm of physical reality. So the observation selection effect would then have an even greater population on which to act. But it suffices if this is the only universe, provided it's sufficiently big.
I'm speaking with Nick Bostrom. He's a visiting scholar in philosophy at Yale University, author of Anthropic Bias, Observation Selection Effects in Science and Philosophy. And he's formerly of the UK and Sweden. Nick, the multiple universes theory, one of the forms of complexity and likelihood that these theorists point to is that at the creation of the universe at the Big Bang, theoretically, we could have had a very, very wide set of constants set at the beginning of the universe. Constants could have been set so that there was no matter, there never would have been matter to coalesce, there never would have been stars, planets. They could have been, those constants could have been set in such a way as there was a preponderance of antimatter over matter, or there was certain kinds of chemical reactions never could have taken place. And so given those statistical unlikelihoods, doesn't your anthropic bias also argue for the existence of multiple universes?
Yeah, the situation is analogous to the case where we just look at our planet. So in the case of just looking at our own planet, the surprising thing is there is complex life walking around on the surface of the Earth, and it's hard to see what processes would have made such a development likely. It seems that the initial conditions of our planet and all the random events just had to turn out in the right way for this to happen, and that seems kind of strange and surprising, prima facie surprising. Similarly with the universe as a whole, you just scale up our view, and instead of looking at what happened on one planet, you look at what happened when our universe came about. The various constants and parameters, as you said, seem exquisitely fine-tuned for enabling complex chemistry, stable environments, and generally a universe where life could exist. The various parameters seem to, as if it were, be balancing on a razor blade, just right values for intelligent life to exist. And that has surprised a lot of people. It seems to many people to cry out for explanation. It's something that, although it could conceivably just happen to be like that for no reason, it's something that tempts one to look beyond it for why would the constants have exactly those values. And basically four different attitudes to this problem exist. One is to dismiss it, to say that, well, you know, science has to stop somewhere. Fundamental physical constants had to have some values, and the ones they do have are no more improbable than any other possible values they could have had. So it's the attitude basically of shrugging our shoulders and just accepting appearances as a brute fact. I think this attitude is misguided because we should always prefer, if there is, a simpler hypothesis to account for the evidence. We shouldn't accept something as a brute fact if there is a good, independently plausible hypothesis to explain it. So that brings us to the remaining three attitudes that one can have. One of these attitudes is that we can hope that future developments in theoretical physics will show that there actually were no other way for these constants to be than the way they are. Maybe some simple unifying theory that from which you could deduce that the constants had to have exactly the right values. And this is a possibility, but right now there is no really plausible theory that would do such a thing. The two remaining attitudes then is, on the one hand, invoking some kind of design hypothesis. You might think that the universe was created either by a god or by some kind of abstract universe creating principle or whatever you had, and that designer decided to give the universe and its parameters exactly those values it has in order to create a universe where life could exist. But the fourth possibility is the one that involves observation selection effects. And in a nutshell, the explanation runs as follows. Suppose our universe isn't the only one, but that there is, as we mentioned earlier, an ensemble of universes, a vast pool of different actually real physical universes out there, and that the physical constants and parameters differs from universe to universe, according to some broad random distribution. Now, if there is such an ensemble, and in only a small number of these universes would the constants be life-permitting, then you can invoke an observation selection effect to account for why we observe a universe that looks like it had been selected or picked out to be observer-containing. We, according to this theory, must observe a very atypical part of the totality of physical existence. Most of physical existence would be lifeless because the constants in all those other universes, or most of them, would not be life-permitting. We would find ourselves in one of the very exceptional universes where things, just by chance, happen to be right. So locally, just looking at our universe, it looks like we are extremely lucky, and as if there were some remarkable miracle that had accounted for our universe being life-permitting. But that's just because we observe only a small part of the whole.
Nick, that's wonderful, and I hope people have a chance to take a look at Anthropic Bias, Observation Selection Effects in Science and Philosophy. I've been speaking with Nick Bostrom. He's a visiting scholar in philosophy at Yale University. He's also the chair of the World Transhumanist Association, which can be found at www.transhumanism.org. Thanks for joining us today, Nick.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
To get what I'm after till the day I die.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the A-Infos Radio Project. Also, at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.